Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie. And advances in medicine have done wonders to keep us alive longer, but the medical community hasn't figured out how to keep us from dying longer. In his new book, and it is terrific, Dr. Atul Gawande calls for the medical community to change the way it approaches death. He writes, quote, "I learned about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them. The way we saw it and the way our professors saw it, the purpose of medical schooling was to teach how to save lives, not to tend to their demise." Dr. Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's, professor at Harvard Medical School, also a staff writer at The New Yorker. His latest book, the one we're talking about, is called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Dr. Gawande, it's a pleasure to meet you. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Well, you talk a lot in your writing and in your book about what you've seen in your own life, your own experience. But let's start in your introduction. You talk about a man, you call him, this is a pseudonym, Joseph Lazaroff. Tell us about his situation and how you handled that.
Well, what's also, it was one of the first people I wrote about when I started writing. So this was as a resident. I saw this man who came in, and my job was to get permission on the permission forms for him to go to surgery. And he had come in. He was becoming paralyzed from a tumor that had involved his spinal cord, and it was a metastatic prostate cancer throughout his body. And he wanted that chance to beat this, is the way he put it. And so the neurosurgeon came in and said, well, let's do this. But this was a guy, he was emaciated. He was, it was clear it was his last weeks. And what he was hoping he would get out of this was not what we were going to deliver. So we, my job was to get his permission. And as soon as I talked about the risks and benefits, he said, there's a risk that I could die. There's a risk I could come out worse from this. What are you talking about? And are you trying to deny me my chance? I said, I'm sorry, and handed it over to him, and he signed away. He went into surgery, and he never made it out. He spent the next 2 weeks on ventilators, just worse and worse and worse, until we finally, with his son, you know, had to take him off. And he never got to say his goodbyes, never a terrible last couple of weeks. And he saw his wife die just this way, saying, this is not the way I want to go. What struck me at the time was, I said, I thought he made the wrong decision. Looking back on it 10, 15 years later, what struck me was we had not helped him make a good decision, that we were never honest with him all along the way, that we had not been talking to him about what he was actually facing until that crisis moment when he was beside his mind with anxiety and fear.
And why are doctors so why do they perform so poorly at this? No training, because it's so hard, because it's not a billable hour? Why is there this colossal absence of, yes, we know how to keep them living longer, we don't know how to work with them so that they die the way that and do the things they want to do?
Well, one of the reasons I zero in on is how the relationship between the doctor and patient has changed over the last 50 years. 50 years ago, it used to be, you know, doctor knows best, and we just tell you what to do. We'd barely tell you about the options. We might not even tell you what's really going on with you because we didn't want to worry your pretty little head. We, as patients, rebelled against that in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and the way I was trained was to be doctor informative. Here is option A and option B and option C, and here's the pros and the cons and the risks and the benefits. And so, you know, when I would talk through something like that, I'd say, well, you know, there's a whole lot of risks here, but, you know, maybe there's some chance that you could survive and get a little bit more time. And the other alternative is you give up and you don't have any time at all. So which one do you want? And what I was not understanding is this core thing I found in researching this book. You know, what I did is I talked to more than 200 patients and family members about their experiences with aging and with serious illness. And also
some of your own family members.
Some of my own family members, yeah. My father, my grandfather. And then also talked to about scores of geriatricians, palliative care specialists, hospice nurses, nursing home attendants about what they saw. And out of it, I saw a picture of some of them who were able to have much more successful conversations and plans and understanding of what happened. And I had two fundamental lessons that came out of that, among others. One was that people turn out to have priorities besides just living longer. Surprise, surprise, but they do. They may be that I want to be cognitively intact, or they may be that I want to be home as much as possible instead of in the hospital, or I just want to have time to hang out with my dog. But the second thing is that the most reliable way to find out what people's priorities are is to ask. And we ask less than one-third of the time what people's priorities are. And we never asked Joseph Lazaroff what his priorities were, and were we helping him achieve them?
But why? Again, that gets back to the question I was asking before. It's sort of like we've never had the discussion about race in this country because it's too hard. Mm-hmm. Is it too hard to have a conversation with someone about dying?
Yeah. So first of all, I described the fear that that doctors and clinicians of all kinds have that you might be offending somebody. I think also when you've handled these discussions in a way that really made people upset or angry, I think sometimes, you know, seeing somebody cry in your office feels like a failure. I think we conceive of ourselves as you know, that death is a kind of failure. It's hard for us to feel it is normal. Add to it that having these conversations take time. And,
that's,
you know,
a big point.
I get paid to do the operation.
Yeah.
I get paid very little to take the time to have these conversations, let alone multiple times. And the result is some of the lowest paid people in our profession, geriatricians, palliative care doctors, primary care physicians.
Contrast the story of Lazaroff with the story of the piano teacher.
Yes. So this is the story of my daughter's piano teacher. We live out here in Newton. My daughter was 13. Her piano teacher had, we thought, beat a cancer.
Young woman, relatively.
Yeah. She was in. Around 60 years old when she was diagnosed with a cancer in her pelvis that had become so bad she had to undergo radical surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and then seemed to be clear of the disease for almost 3 years, but developed a side effect of her chemotherapy, a cause of leukemia that she was undergoing treatment for. She kept teaching through that. And then suddenly for 2 weeks she canceled lessons. Turned out she was in the hospital. She called from there with her husband to speak to me. And she was now really in trouble. Her cancer was back. Her leukemia wasn't responding to treatment. She had infections. She was in terrible pain. She'd been in pain for 2 weeks in bed, become incontinent. And she said, what do I do? And the question was, does she go for some kind of experimental therapy because the doctors had no standard options? Or does she go on hospice and, as she put it, give up? And I hadn't known how to have that conversation, but I tried the conversation that palliative care doctors had. And I asked her some basic questions. I said, you know, what is your understanding of your condition? And she said, I'm going to die. I'm going to die very soon. I said, if time is short, what are your goals? And she said, I don't have any goals I can think of. So then I said, well, what are your fears and worries
for the future?
Is it hard
to ask that question? What are your fears?
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt. But
it is hard. But it's not nearly as hard as doing stuff like saying, well, here are the facts. You know, you got a 90% chance of death in the next 2 weeks. And, you're not offering a human side. And it's far easier just to say, well, what are your fears and your worries? It's saying, I'm on your side. And she said, my fears, I'm going to be in pain. I'm not going to be relieved of pain. I'm never going to get home. I'm never going to get to see family. I'm never going to have anything left. And what we recognized was, well, then let's fight for that. I think if she had been given the option of death with dignity, you know, assisted suicide.
Defeated on the ballot in Massachusetts,
yes. So,
which could get Marjorie started, but go ahead.
Well, I think that many people in her situation would have taken that option. Mm-hmm. But what we said was, what if you fought for not longer time, but just having a good day? And what if we used our medical capabilities just to fight to have you have a good day? And she said, it's been so long since I had a good day. Let's do that. We signed up for hospice. She and her husband, you know, went home. A hospice nurse arrived and they said, what would a good day be for you? And at first it was just, you know, let's get rid of the pain. And so she got the pain medication. It took 3 different drugs, got it under control. And then she lifted her sights and we got this amazing phone call. I told my daughter, you know, you're not going to have lessons anymore. Peg is dying. And she said, "Can I see her?" And she said, I don't think so. I don't think it's likely. And then she called herself, Peg. Peg called and said, "You know, I'd like to teach again." And we had Hunter ended up with 4 weeks of piano lessons every week. And then Peg had a recital of all the children who she had taught. They played for her. They played Brahms and Dvorak and Beethoven. And she wanted that chance to give that last something. Each of the children afterwards went up and she gave them a personal gift. For my daughter, it was a book of music she'd selected that she wanted her to learn. and then put her arm around her and said, "You're special." And just wanted every child, she told that to every child, she wanted every child to know that. That's the legacy she wanted to have. And so she got a kind of passing that, you know, in our obtuseness in medicine, we don't provide. Those moments are incredibly important to people in their lives. It's some of the most important moments in people's lives.
Yeah, but we're talking to Dr. Atul Gawande, who's written this terrific new book. You obviously know the subject matter. If you've been listening, Being Mortal, Medicine, What Matters in the End. You mentioned this one-third statistic where it actually happens. The Institute of Medicine did something, Dying in America, whatever it was, recently. Yeah. They said what you said, obviously. 30% get it. And 90% want it. I don't buy that. Well, I understand that part of the problem is the doctor who's not ready, he or she, to do this, or not equipped, or not psychologically able, not trained. I tried to put my, after having read some of these stories in your book, including about your father, I say to myself, would I want to answer those kinds of questions? What are my fears? What do I want? Or do I want to live in blissful ignorance like so many patients do? Maybe you can fix me. And I'm not sure I would want to be asked those questions. And I'm not sure I would want to be honest. Am I wrong in that? Do you think patients want it more than I think they want it? You do, obviously. And what's the evidence of that?
No, so there's a couple of things. Number one, denial is normal.
That's what I was trying to say. Okay.
You know, I mean, there are people who all the way through do not, and you can actually harm people. That's one thing that comes across from the evidence is that, you know, trying to force down somebody's throat that, you know, you're going to die tomorrow. You know, that is not what you want to do. But, you know, it's really interesting. A palliative care expert or a hospice physician, they treat the conversation the same way I treat the operations that I do, as something that requires skill and practice and technique. And they've developed certain techniques. And one of them is that that when we have these conversations, it's not about me, you know. One of the things they said to me is, if I'm talking more than half of the time that we are in the appointment, I have failed. And then I paid attention in my appointments when I broke bad news, and I spoke more than 90% of the time. It's just a person nodding on the other end.
Trying to fill the air.
Air with facts and you know, emotional stuff, that, and yet not acknowledging what the other person is even thinking. And what they say is, just start with, what is your understanding of your condition? And people will tell you. They'll either say, you know, like they pegged it, you know, I'm going to die. Or I'm afraid I'm going to die. I don't know when, but this is going to happen. Or they might say, I'm going to beat this. You know, and I feel like I'm good. And
what do you do when you know that not to be true?
And well, what you say is, you know, how much do you want to know about the statistics? What do you want to know? And if they say right now, I'm good with where I am, that's the other thing, is you don't need to solve it today. This is a process. And the fact that, you know, what happens, I call it the ODTAA syndrome, the one damn thing after another syndrome, when, you know, you get, you know, we all will reach a point where we were seriously ill or have troubles. And it's when it becomes one damn thing after another that you're on this train that you don't get off. And, you know, if it's not at one moment, it's the next moment that people start to say, okay, I am willing to talk about this. You know, we're all fighting for the best case scenario. Let's keep in mind what is the worst case scenario. And what can we do to know what your priorities are? I think there is no – people don't have trouble being willing to tell us what are the most important things that we work on.
Which the voice you hear is that of Atul Gawande. His latest book is Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. You just mentioned a couple of things I want to follow up on. First of all, death with dignity. That was a ballot question that lost big time. Some people call it assisted suicide. What do you think about that, people having the wherewithal to stockpile pills if they want to and to control their last moments?
I have a complicated view on this. Number one, I think that there are people who have unbearable suffering and that it would be heartless not to be able to offer options mm-hmm. that allow people to have a prescription to give them some freedom from that. So I think in Oregon and Washington, it's been handled well. Less than 1% of people who die end up requesting and receiving the prescription. And what's really interesting is only half end up using it because it's just the peace of mind
yes.
knowing that it is there.
Which I think is a big deal.
Yeah, that if I reach that suffering. And this is the second part, is that fear indicates that our health system has failed people. Because what they fear is that there is no doctor and there is no nurse who is willing to make sure that I am not going to be suffering or have my priorities violated. And what we see, I think, is that it is far easier to assist with dying than it is to assist with living. And the goal is not a good death. I think that it troubles me when people say, you know, how do we assure people have a good death? The goal is to have as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. And that's what, you know, a hospice nurse was able to provide PEG. I'll just point out that the Netherlands was the first country to have assisted suicide. And one of the things I think was a consequence, it was one of the last countries in Europe to actually have palliative care and hospice develop as a set of services for people. Because when you're suffering, it was far easier to just, you know, give people this way out. And in a country like, you know, I did a bunch of reporting from India for this, an investigation in India. And, you know, you see China, you see Korea. You know, you give assisted suicide, but you've built, you know, they literally give people no pain medication for severe problems. And, you know, people will choose that way out. If you say, I'm not going to give you pain medication, well, then, yeah. I'll kill me now.
Okay.
So, Dr. Atul Gawande, you've already changed the world. People know the checklist. It has changed the medical world. We know that. So what will the world be changed here with Dying in America out of the Institute of Medicine, your book, which I'm sure is going to be wildly well read? Will medical schools and will the medical infrastructure say, we do have to train our people to do this? Maybe one of the ways to get them from here to there is with a checklist. I mean, what happens next if people buy your line of thinking, which I assume they will? What happens?
Well, so the biggest thing is that if we recognize people have priorities besides just, you know, survival and their safety, it moves all the way up the chain. Half of the book ends up being about homes for the aged. And we're already seeing not only that we're going to have medical schools and have health systems that are willing to talk to people about what their priorities are as they near the end of life, but this is about what happens as the quality of your life diminishes even well before death.
Give some examples of the places that really get it right that you talk about in your book.
Well, here's this classic example. I visited a place up here in Chelsea that has rebuilt the nursing home, still on the same amount of money, but they, instead of building the units around a nursing station where the whole goal is, you know, are you safe? They built it around a kitchen. And in the kitchen, the elderly people could go to the refrigerator and they could take food out of the refrigerator. Do you know how controversial that is?
Why?
Because if you go to the refrigerator and you're diabetic, you might take a soda and that's not safe. It's not healthy. You know, the reason why, and then what do people say? When can I go home? Because in my home, I can go to the refrigerator and I can not only take out a soda, I can take out a beer.
Exactly.
Verboten. I mean, that's crazy, right? So an Alzheimer's patient can get written up. I mean, so by the way, this is a place where you can get written up, right, for violating rules. And an Alzheimer's patient, you know, can be assigned to have pureed food. And what do they get written up for? Hoarding cookies. Like, let them have the damn cookie. We can make places into homes. And what they showed in Chelsea is that you can make it a place, and this is called a construction called greenhouses that allow people to kind of grow and continue to learn and do things that are their own goals. And, you know, half of the patients there have dementia. That it can be a place where, because you allow people to take certain kinds of risks, they actually can be happier. They feel more purpose. They you know, you focus on how do they have connections to others, including, you know, others in the units.
So obvious because they're allowed to live. I mean,
but you worry about the liability. That's what I think a lot of nurses are afraid of.
So we worry about the liability. And yet these people do not die sooner. On average, they die later. They have, you know, no more falls. But it is one of those kinds of things that requires us to change our frame. It is that people have priorities besides just safety and living longer. Here's another class example. Up in Reading, Mass., I visited a place run by this amazing woman named Jackie Carson. It's a low-income housing project for seniors. And what she arranged is a woman named Ruth Barrett, who has she has some dementia. She's missing like 30 years. But she makes choices every day about what she loves and what she wants to do. She's in a wheelchair. She needs lots of care. But what she loves is being with people. She loves going out. And so they arrange every Friday that she can go out with friends. And she loves to go to a TGI Friday. So they take her to a TGI Friday. And what does she like to order at the TGI Friday? A margarita. So they triple up, you know, the depends on her. They let her order the margarita. It is totally against the rules. And she is having a joyful, purposeful life. There are miseries. There are ups and downs. It is real life. You know, but it is not life in a prison.
So if there is change, Dr. Gawande, is it going to be because people realize this is the humane, kinder and gentler way to treat our fellow men? Or is it because they read your statistics? Or what is it? 25% of Medicare is spent on people, the 5% of their last year of life, where they say it's also economically good policy. What moves people more in your industry?
I think, in the end, it's going to be about what people demand before the medical industry demands it, right? And people are not going – I think this generation of baby boomers, as they enter into having needs, number one, they're going to want to be at home longer and want to have capacity more. But when they end up needing help, whether it's in at the end of life or in needing a place that will take care of them – people want to be in places where they have autonomy, where they have some control over what the story of their life is and how it unfolds. And so they will demand it and force it. I think that will lead to changes in the way we pay. You know, we're already seeing a shift coming out of healthcare reform and other areas that are pushing us away from just pay for quantity in healthcare. But it's very true that the almighty dollar does speak in healthcare, and it doesn't happen unless we also change the way physicians are paid so that they are enabled and rewarded to take the time to talk to people.
We have less than a minute left. Should a doctor start this conversation when you are close to dying, or can they start having this conversation with a patient when they're 40 or 50, or you know what I mean?
I think that knowing what your priorities are, it can start at any time, but it's clearly the moments when you start having some real struggles that aren't fixable. We're not very good at dealing with the problems we can't repair, and the way we become good at these issues you can't repair, that when we're up against it, then we start talking about, you know, what are your fears and what are your goals if these are problems that we are not going to be able to completely fix?
Atul Gawande, it was a pleasure. This is
absolutely
a great and important work.
It's a
great book. And thanks for joining us.
No one wants to think about this. That's the other thing. But I've been thinking about it very much these last couple of days. Thank you very much. Dr. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard Medical School. He's also a staff writer. He writes terrific stuff at The New Yorker. His latest book is Being Mortal Medicine and What Matters in the End. It'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. The event is sold out, but you can also see him October 30th at the Good Shepherd Institute annual dinner at the Westin Hotel in Waltham. Up next, Governor Deval Patrick, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Gawande.
Thank you.